Hey, folks, you're going to love this edition of the Just Right podcast. Listen, Conrad Thompson is one of the most interesting people I think I've ever met. In his 20s, he started a very successful mortgage company, was living the dream, and then somehow or another, he stumbled into becoming what he calls an accidental podcaster. He is now the world's largest podcaster for professional wrestling. Major stars on his show all the time. Oh, by the way, he was recently inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, and he's never stepped inside the ring. It's the coolest story. You're going to be inspired by it. You're going to be basically trying to figure out how to do more of that yourself. All of it is what I would call just right. Y'all stay tuned. Yeah, let's do a show. 1, 2, 3, hey! Conrad Thompson, welcome to the Just Right podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. Beautiful man. Gadsden, Alabama.
Are you kidding? We're glad to have you. This is like an honor. I'm pretty sure that we should have had pyrotechnics and smoke when you walked in the door. Is that the way this works?
No.
All right, let's talk. I'm going to do a quick introduction.
Okay.
Let everybody know who's sitting here with me. So, you're just an everyday guy.
Yep.
Is what you portray.
Well, that's real.
However, you run a mortgage company. You've been doing that for a long time.
Yes.
We'll talk interest rates later. But oh, by the way, you're also not only a very successful mortgage broker, but you married Ric Flair's daughter, got into the world of podcasting. Next thing you know, you're inducted into the World Wrestling Hall of Fame. And somehow or another, you've become one of the biggest podcasters / broadcasters / event organizers in the world of professional wrestling. Am I right?
Pretty close.
All right.
It is. When you say it like that, it sounds more interesting, I think, than it really is. But thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm glad you're here, man.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I just want to get to know you.
Sure.
So first of all, there's what I would call the more sedate side of your professional life.
Yes.
You're a mortgage broker.
Well, banker, but same thing.
Banker,
yeah, mortgage,
I apologize.
Mortgage banker, yeah.
So how's that going, and how do you balance all of it?
A great support team. You know, I've started doing it August 27th, 2001, so just a couple of weeks before 9/11.
Oh, wow.
And I had just turned 20. I'll turn 44 later this year, and that's all I've ever done. So I've done mortgages longer than I was alive without mortgages, even through grade school. So it's kind of all I've ever known. But I started advertising a lot in the Huntsville market on radio and television in 2009, and I expanded to Nashville in 2010 and 11 and Chattanooga after that, and then somehow, someway, became an accidental podcaster in 2015 with Ric Flair, and in 2016, he introduced me to his daughter, and in 2018, we got married, and yeah, it's a pretty crazy story how it all sort of dovetailed together.
I thought that my life was eclectic. But then I reviewed some of yours as I got ready for today, and I thought, no, I got nothing.
Well, it has been an interesting life. But what's interesting to me is that you and I are 1 degree separated, that yes. My best friend in life,
yes.
The guy who actually performed the ceremony between me and my wife, was a guy who I think you were kind of like his youth pastor of sorts.
I was, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How fun is that? Casio Kid, shout out.
Casio Kid, shout out. We love you still.
Yes, absolutely.
And what's kind of cool is I made the joke earlier that tell him I've still got pictures, but then again, he may come back and say, tell him I got more.
I love that. I love that. Pictures when he had hair.
That's
it
exactly
wouldn't even
right.
Look like him. He's got plausible deniability. That guy's got hair. That's not me.
Hey, listen, so on the mortgage broker side of you, you still do that though, right?
Oh, yeah, every day. Yes, sir.
I said broker, it's banker.
But no difference. I help families get into mortgages. I help people realize the dream of home ownership and then understand that they can reorganize their debt. Like right now, there's a lot of families who are struggling because, as you've probably heard, credit card debt is at an all-time high. Yeah. At the end of January, a report came out that said that America had $1.21 trillion in credit card debt. It's never been that high.
No.
And if you take a look from the pandemic to now, it's almost like a hockey stick. It's just through the roof. And I think the reason that is because people are hesitant to refinance out of their low-rate mortgages they locked down during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So they'll say things to me, Phil, like, well, you know, I'm rate sensitive, so I'm not going to refinance at a greater rate. But I almost challenge that, Phil, respectfully to say, how rate sensitive are you really if you've maxed out a credit card at 31%?
Yeah.
Like once you owe it, it's up to you to figure out how to pay it back. And not only is the interest rate you have on a credit card astronomically high, but the interest you pay on a credit card is not tax deductible, whereas the interest you pay on a mortgage is. So if you could get a cheaper payment and a greater tax deduction, improve your credit score, give yourself more room on that credit card in case something disastrous happens, and lower your monthly payments in the process, how do you lose? But a lot of families just don't really understand that, and they're just taught to think, well, I got a great rate on the mortgage. I need to leave that alone. But it's impeding their ability to take their kids to the movies or go get ice cream or just life.
So you've actually done this for a bit. I can tell by the way you verbalize it. Sure. Comes right on out. And I guess, too, let me ask you this, because this is a, I'm going to chase a rabbit for a second. We all watched the economy over the last 4 years, just the cycles of just craziness, 40-year high inflation, COVID pandemic set the rates low, trying to get the economy back, stimulation money being thrown in. Just it was madness.
Yes.
It was cats and dogs living together. It was all of it. Are you seeing people returning to the table, though? I mean, that conversation you said you can have with people on a regular basis. I do a lot of real estate law.
Mm-hmm.
You do the other side of it. You're the lender side. Are you seeing people coming back to the table, so to speak?
A little bit. I mean, the people who are in a bad place, or life has dictated that they need to make a move.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, maybe there's a divorce, or a loved one passes away, or there's an empty nester, or someone retires, or they lose their job. Those are the type of people who are making moves right now. But people are still buying houses. People are starting a new career, and they're excited to have a fresh new start in a new town or a new market. And their life has dictated that they have to buy something else. But I look at here locally, you think about Huntsville, Alabama. There's over 500 jobs that have been announced, and there's rumors it's more, that will be coming from the FBI down to Huntsville. I mean, Cash Patel was just there last week saying, we hope to bring a lot more than just those 500 jobs. Well, that means there's 500 families, moms and dads, usually a two-family income or two-income household. They've now got to relocate their whole life to Huntsville, Alabama. Now, you and I know Huntsville's awesome. But this wasn't anybody in D.C.'s original plan.
No.
Like, they have jobs. Like, probably only one of those people work for the FBI, but the other person has a job there.
They're also going to find out they can buy a lot more house here than they can in D.C.
Absolutely.
But some of them never owned a house, and now they'll be able to.
But are people going to rush to buy their existing house in D.C.? See, that's the problem is they've got to sell a house there at the same time everybody else is leaving D.C., so now there's more inventory than ever before. Are they going to be upside down? Yes, their dollar goes further in Huntsville than it does D.C., but if they've still got a mortgage hanging around up there, boy, it's a real challenge. So we've got to get some sort of relief with interest rates. I believe this firmly. As interest rates go, so does the economy.
Yeah.
You know, if we can get real estate moving again, our economy will fix itself. So much of what our economy in America is based on is our single biggest asset. And for most families, that's their house. And so they're not really putting that big asset into play. The economy isn't at full scale. So I think there's pent up. Think about if you had a crank and a water hose. That's what we've got right now.
Yeah.
You've got a ton of folks who want to buy another home. Their current home no longer suits their needs, but they're not going to let go of this great rate. And they know that home sales are slowing. I mean, there's more listings on the market. There's more inventory than there's been in a while. But by the time, you know, we unkink that hose with low interest rates, we're going to be back in a 2020 situation where we have more buyers than we have inventory. Those prices will come back. So I do think now, if you're a savvy investor or if you're willing to see what's coming, interest rate relief will be there. You can still get great deals on homes right now. If you wait until the rates are better, you will have missed it. I mean, you remember how crazy that was. Multiple offers the same day. It was bananas.
We were doing five, six, seven closings a week in my small firm. Mm. And it was in a market, by the way, where I'm at right now that is not Huntsville, Alabama.
Right.
Which is, I'm not a depressed market by any stretch, but the refinance especially was going through the roof with the rates.
Yes.
All right. So let me ask you this. I can hear the passion in your voice. It's obvious you love what you do and you're a professional at what you do. Which one's more fun, this or the podcasting wrestling side of your life?
Well, listen, that's hard to answer.
Me and you talking. Which one's more fun?
You know, the figuring out how to structure a deal is fun. Laughing and cutting up with my buddies, telling inappropriate jokes to make people laugh about old wrestling stories, that is more fun.
Yeah.
But there's nothing more rewarding than feeling like you had a meaningful impact on someone's life.
Yeah.
And I realized that we can do that with the mortgage business. I mean, I routinely help people experience, you know, a $1,500 a month savings. I mean, that's like they had a second really nice part-time job because that's like net dollars. So think about how much you would have to earn in order to bring home $1,500. Like, that allows families to do more for their kids, for their moms, for their dads, be more, you know, active in their community. Just relief and peace of mind. That's what it's about.
So I guess in essence, I'm going to paraphrase slightly, but do you feel like you're helping people no matter which side of your professional life you're on?
I do. I mean, I whenever we do live events on the podcast side, I always do a meet and greet before. You know, me and my co-host would do a VIP meet and greet. And you'd be surprised how many people get emotional at the table when they say, hey, man, when my mom died or my spouse died or my son was diagnosed with leukemia, I needed an escape. And just listening to you guys talk about old wrestling brought me back to that place when I was a young person and watching wrestling with my grandfather or whatever. So just stirring up those feelings of nostalgia and giving people a fun distraction does have value.
Sure does.
But I'm not interfacing with those folks on a one-to-one basis as often as I am the customers and families that we serve on the mortgage side.
Well, you mentioned old wrestling.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm an old guy. So I'm thinking back to the days of like Tojo Yamamoto,
yes,
and Gorgeous George,
oh, yeah,
and you know, and Rowdy Roddy Piper.
The best.
And I mean, these were the guys of my day. I can still remember sitting in my granny and granddaddy's kitchen in Birmingham with the black and white TV on the roller stand over there in the corner of the kitchen, and looking at my granddaddy, he's like, "Granddaddy, that man just hit another man with a metal chair."
Yes.
You know, and as a kid, just watch. In fact, one of the funniest ones to me was Tojo Yamamoto used to do a commercial for a bed company, and he would jump on the mattress as proof that the mattress could hold up his weight.
I love it.
And then they would come back and they would say, "And if you don't buy from so-and-so bedding town, Tojo wants to know," and he'd come on and go, "What's the matter, you?" And that was the whole commercial. But that whole culture was built around those old guys.
Yes.
But over time, it became far, far more than what we used to watch in the small arenas on the black and white TV.
Yes.
I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar sport now.
No doubt about it. You know, it continues to get larger and larger, too. I mean, WWE is experiencing their greatest success ever right now, and a lot of people are really impressed with that, considering it's happening sort of post-Vince McMahon. He's sort of like the Walt Disney of the pro wrestling world.
And yeah,
now that he's out of the picture, I think a lot of people were keeping an eye on it, wondering, what does this look like without Vince McMahon? And we found out. It's a hugely successful, publicly traded business under the TKO banner. Nick Khan and Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro, they're printing money for WWE right now, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so you're a mortgage broker guy.
Yep.
I keep calling it that.
That's all right.
You're a mortgage guy. Listen to mortgage guy. You're a mortgage guy.
That's what I call myself on Twitter, Conrad the Mortgage Guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Conrad the Mortgage Guy,
yeah,
meets Ric Flair.
Yep.
And then now you're married into the Flair family.
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
She was Ric Flair's daughter. Now she's Conrad Thompson's wife. There you go.
Play that for his kids.
No, I'm just saying, realistically, you know, I'm not Conrad Flair, but she is Megan Thompson.
That's perfect.
Yeah, so no, she joined my family, and we're delighted to have her. But, yeah, it's sort of a happy accident. I met Rick at an autograph event in Rome, Georgia, of all places. And that was in, I believe it was November of 2013. And sadly, he had lost his son Reed to an overdose in March of that year. Mm. So he was in a challenging headspace, but we quickly headed off, and he was looking for a friend. And respectfully, he was looking for a friend to go drinking with. And so I signed up to do it. And one of my friends said, "Hey, man, how many times are you going to drink beer and watch sports with Ric Flair?" And I said, "About as often as I can, I guess. That sounds like fun to me." So that's what we did. And so we just became drinking buddies. And one day, I think we were watching the NFL draft. He said, "Hey, what's a podcast? Can you make any money with a podcast?" And I said, "Well, I don't know if you can make money with a podcast, but show me your phone. I'll show you how it works." That was 2014.
So before podcasts were even cool,
really? Yeah, well, I guess, yeah. CBS had reached out to him and offered him a podcast. So in 2015, he launched Woo Nation
on Play.it,
yeah, which was a CBS platform. And he would go into the radio station on Peachtree in downtown Atlanta and record his podcast. And he got nervous 2 days beforehand. He said, "Conrad, it just feels weird, me just being alone in a room talking to a microphone.
I get that.
Will you come in to the studio and just let me, you ask me fan questions?" And I said, "Sure." So I thought, man, I don't know how many people are going to hear this, but I don't want to embarrass myself. So I did a lot of production notes, and I walked in with notes for he and I had things bolded and highlighted and all that.
Yeah.
And the people there at CBS said, "Hey, who is this guy and why is he here?" And Rick said, oh, he's just going to sit in this episode and ask me fan questions. But at the end, CBS said, can you come back next week? That was pretty good. So I became an accidental podcaster. It wasn't the plan. But about a month in, I realized, you know, I've been spending like $100,000 a month on marketing in Nashville, Huntsville, and Chattanooga to promote my mortgage company. But people can hear this all over the world, and I'm not paying for it. I need to get licensed in more states than just Alabama and Tennessee. Yeah. And I need to start driving traffic that way. So I quickly did. We went from an ad budget of $100,000 a month. That was the real number for our mortgage company, to $0. And it's all just through podcasts. And we experienced phenomenal growth. We had a much bigger platform because of the podcast. So anytime I get a chance to come on a show like yours, I jump at the chance. I believe in the medium. And I know that, you know, podcasting is a great way to grow small business. And I hope everyone listening to this embraces it.
Well, and I appreciate that, and I agree. And in fact, I would call myself somewhat accidental and late in life too. That,
okay.
At that point, you know, I got a call out of nowhere. Would I do a radio show? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And next thing you know, here I am, radio, podcasting, and all of it.
Yeah.
And really watching something grow. And it's like you. I'm a dual career guy. I've got a law firm, and yet I don't know which one I spend more time on. To be honest
right.
with you. In fact, I probably really do. Here I am sitting with you. But the truth of the matter is, it's a hoot, and you get to do what I call impacting culture.
Yes.
And that's where I feel like my calling is impacting culture, and having an opportunity to be a part of the mix and to express something that other people might go, oh, that's what I've been trying to figure out the words to say. Mm-hmm. And if I can get that done in a day, I feel like I've done my gig.
Absolutely.
All right, that being said, let me ask you, so the accidental podcaster,
mm-hmm.
But it didn't just stop with the one. You had Woo Nation, you and Ric Flair.
That's right.
Which is not currently going now, if I'm not mistaken, right?
No, CBS closed Play.it. CBS Radio actually sold. So when they sunset that, Rick and I had already decided, hey, we can monetize this and sell this better on our end if we just take over sales and everything. At that point, we were, quote unquote, just talent. But I, as an entrepreneur and small business owner, I was like, I think there's more money to be made if we just control it all.
Yeah.
So I pitched him on, let's just launch our own show independently. And my buddy Dave Green, who I met because he ran the Cumulus Cluster in Huntsville, which right. features one of your fabulous shows on WVNN, he had moved back home to St. Louis. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, do you think you could represent me as our ad sales guy? And he said, absolutely. So we came up with, using my graphics girl, like a slate for him to pitch and where we could, you know, pitch some sales. And it worked. So the success of the Ric Flair Show, which we launched, and somehow it debuted at number one on the sports charts, I said, hey, you know what? This is great, but I sure would like to get some more of those leads the other 4 days of the work week, because I had been used to advertising my mortgage company through the radio Monday
sure.
through Friday with
right.
live ads. Because I would call into the station and say what's going on and tell today's success story or what have you. So I thought, I need to build more shows. So I had, through a different project, I was doing some recruiting in Nashville, and I wanted to shoot a campaign targeting guys who had worked in the auto finance industry. They understand sales, they understand interfacing with customers, and they understand finance. So I thought, these guys are natural to do it in the mortgage business, but a much better quality of life. Anybody who's worked in the car business can tell you it's just a grueling grind of a schedule. So to be able to get back more of that time and perhaps earn more money, I thought, hey, this is a home run. So I reached out to a former WWE producer who had produced a bunch of their stuff through the years for guys like The Rock or Stone Cold or The Undertaker. And I said, help me come up with a compelling commercial. So we worked on it for the better part of a week. And near the end of one of our shooting days, we're just collapsing on my couch at the house like, whew, what a long day. And as we're just shooting the breeze, I said, hey, man, what happened when? And I asked a very specific wrestling question. And he adjusted in his seat, and we talked about it, and he told me the story. His name is Bruce Prichard.
Okay.
And at the time, he had worked at a Volvo dealership. And then after that, he had worked managing a law firm for a great close personal friend of his named Rob Taylor in Houston, who was really an icon in the mesothelioma and asbestos and all that sort of stuff back in the day. Anyway, I'm saying all that to say he thought he was completely done with wrestling and wrestling was done with him. But what I heard that day, I was convinced at the end of that conversation. I said, Bruce, we should do a podcast.
You heard the institutional knowledge.
And he said, who wants yeah. to hear me talk? And I go, dude, every wrestling fan would be riveted by what you just said. The only trouble is we didn't record it. But if we would have recorded that and posted it, it would be the most viral wrestling podcast there is. Well, eventually I convince him to let's just record a few for fun.
How long was the eventually? How long did it take?
Maybe 3 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, because he had just the way it actually happened is he had just launched a t-shirt store on prowrestlingtees.com. So the idea would be if you were no longer contracted by WWE, but you still had a little bit of name recognition, think like a million-dollar man Ted DiBiase. Yeah. Then they were selling shirts that looked like the million-dollar man's jacket. It's just a black t-shirt, but it looks like it. So it's just a fun, if you get it, it's retro wrestling, you get it. Well, he had some for his Brother Love character that he portrayed in 1988. And I said, here's the thing. I can sell some mortgages. You can sell some t-shirts. What's the downside? So we started doing the show, and before we knew it, we were getting hundreds of thousands of listens on every episode.
How cool was that?
And what's interesting is the day that show debuted, and that's really the one that put us on the map, and we won Sports Illustrated's Podcast of the Year and all that other stuff. That show debuted on the very same day I had my first date with my now wife.
No kidding.
It's a pretty important day in the history of my life.
Remember the date?
August 3rd.
Okay.
August 3rd.
Don't go down that road and not name
that's
the
date. That's right. That's right.
Well, that's very cool. So how long did that one run?
It's still going now.
Oh, that's the one that's still going.
What's interesting is we started in 2016, in August of 2016, and by February of 2019, Vince McMahon had called and hired him back to work in creative. And as we're talking now, he's the executive vice president and creative director of WWE. So depending on who you ask, he's one of the most five or six most influential people in wrestling. But it was our podcast that sort of was the foray in him getting back into it. So with the success of the Bruce Show, I said, hey, that was the WWF side of things. What if we did one for their biggest competitor, WCW? And I reached out to Tony Schiavone, who was on TBS from 1983 until 2001. Yeah. But then he left and started calling Minor League Baseball. And when I met him, he actually was working at Starbucks because his family needed insurance. And I said, hey, man, here's what I did with Bruce. I think, you know, we could make some money here and raise the profile for you if you were interested. And the timing was perfect because he had just found out his daughter was getting married. He had a new wedding bill coming, oh, and he's like, hey, let's do it. So we made a gentleman's agreement. I'll sell some mortgages, and I'll let you keep all the ad revenue until we get this wedding paid for. Well, when it was done, we just kind of assumed, well, is that the end of the podcast? And we did a podcast from the wedding reception where we announced, no, we're not canceling the podcast. We're going to keep it going. Well, when Tony Khan, whose father owns the Jacksonville Jaguars, decided he wanted to open his own wrestling league, he was a big listener to our podcast. So he reached out and said, can you get me in touch with Schiavone? I want him to do what he's doing for you, for us. So now every Wednesday night he's on TBS, and every Saturday night he's on TNT.
Isn't that
Tony
cool?
Schiavone's back in wrestling. So
isn't that cool?
It's super fun.
It's just amazing. And, you know, you call it the accidental podcaster.
Yes.
I'll be honest with you. I don't think anything's an accident.
I agree.
And I don't think anything about what you described was accidental either. It's obvious your entrepreneurial spirit keeps kicking in.
Oh, yeah. I'm having a blast.
Well, that also comes out. Let me ask you this. Podcasting ain't where it stops.
No.
Now you got a thing called StarCast.
That's right.
So StarCast is like legit and brings in people from all over the world and
Comic-Con for wrestling.
There you go. I mean, it's literally, it's a conference. It's multi-days long, and it brings in all the personalities and the crowds. And you just had one, didn't you? We've got one coming up.
That's right. This July, and right next to where the Cowboys play. It's actually where the Rangers play at Globe Life Field. There's a hotel right in that
same
parking
lot. Well, how did this start?
You
went from podcasts, and now you're doing conferences. What's the genesis of that?
Well, it's a great story. The major league in wrestling for years and years and years, since 2001, had been WWE and pretty much WWE only. And the leading journalist, we'll call it like what Mel Kiper is to the NFL draft, in the wrestling space, his name's Dave Meltzer. And he has a newsletter called the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. And Dusty Rhodes, another famous old school wrestler,
oh, yeah,
his youngest son, Cody, had grown frustrated with WWE creative, so he quit. Probably a $500,000 a year job, and bet on himself saying, I think I can do better outside the tent. So he was hitting the indies and doing well. But a fan asked Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter on Twitter, do you think anyone outside of WWE could ever sell a 10,000-seat arena in the United States again? And Dave said, nope, I don't see it. And Cody couldn't help himself, being the son of a legend like the American Dream Dusty Rhodes, and says, I'll take that bet, Dave. So we got together with the Young Bucks, a fabulous tag team out of California, And they agreed that they would put their money where their mouth is, and they would rent the Sears Arena in Hoffman Estates on the outskirts of Chicago. It was a 10,000-seater. And they were going to put tickets on sale and make a big splash and try to prove Dave wrong, that wrestling doesn't start and end with WWE. It can exist outside of there. Well, I got engaged that January, and we did it in Mexico, the engagement, I mean, when I say did it. So I bump into Cody at International Baggage Claim. He's coming back from like the Japanese equivalent of WrestleMania. It happens on January 4th every year in Tokyo at the Tokyo Dome. It's called Wrestle Kingdom for New Japan Pro Wrestling. So he's trying to be low-key. He's in a hoodie, but I saw him and he saw me. But we wind up texting each other like, hey, good to see you, that sort of thing. And I took my shot. I said, hey, man, I know you guys are planning a big show. You haven't announced any details yet, but people are going to piggyback you around your event, and they're going to have ancillary events, smaller independent wrestling events, little conventions with legends or meet and greets and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What if you just co-opted me and I created like a convention based around wrestling podcasters? So you would sort of co-opt all the media and coverage for your event and make it feel bigger.
What year are we talking about?
2018.
Okay.
So we could do, you know, weigh-ins and press conferences. And I just want to make your event feel bigger than just the one, hey, we're going to the arena for this three-hour event and that's it. Let's make it a whole destination for wrestling fans for the weekend. He loved the idea. I asked that I put it on paper so he could show Matt and Nick of the Young Bucks. They loved it. Asked a fourth partner, Kenny Omega, who at the time was the New Japan World Champion. He liked it. So we launched it. And what we created was like the Woodstock of wrestling. I have to admit, I did not know what I was doing, but that's how all business is. At first, you're just trying to figure it out as you go.
Ain't that the truth?
So we didn't know what we didn't know, and I probably sold too many tickets.
You're probably better off not knowing, as a matter of fact, going into it.
Absolutely.
To some degree.
Not knowing led to me creating some stuff that other people have copied and some stuff they didn't copy, and thankfully was never repeated because it didn't work. But that's how you learn. You do A and B testing, and we do more of what works and less of what doesn't.
So did they win the bet on the first one? Did they fill the arena?
They sold it out in a half hour. Didn't take any time at all. We set all kinds of records, and the idea was that was sort of proof of concept for Tony Khan, who I mentioned owns the Jaguars,
right,
to create his own company called All Elite Wrestling. So that happened on September 1st, 2018, and on January 1st, 2019, they announced that Cody Rhodes, Kenny Omega, and the Young Bucks had just formed their brand-new company with Tony Khan called All Elite Wrestling, which is where my buddies Jeff Jarrett, Jim Ross, and Tony Schiavone, that I'll do all their podcasts, they're all with AEW now. And I don't know without All In that AEW would even exist. So to know that I was even remotely involved in any of that. And then when Tony did the little kickoff announcement saying, hey, we're creating a new rival league and our top star is going to be Chris Jericho, that was a big surprise because he's a well-established name.
Yeah,
he wanted to host a rally outside of the Jaguar Stadium in Jacksonville in the parking lot. And he called me to host it and MC it. And I'm like, I'm a mortgage guy from Gunnersville. Why am I here? I'm like the Forrest Gump of wrestling. But I got to do it and jumped at the chance.
That's what you are. You're the Forrest Gump of wrestling.
I am.
You don't even realize how much you've touched. You just keep on touching.
I guess. You got any Dr. Pepper around here?
Somewhere.
Right?
A box of chocolates.
Just want to say this. Megan is not Jenny. I just need to get that on the record. Nothing like Jenny or Jenna. But maybe that makes Cassio my Bubba.
That's what it is.
I like that.
It's got to be.
I like that.
So let me ask you. You went from podcasting, so-called accidentally.
Yeah.
That grew into more and more podcasting.
That's right.
That grew into success with launching other podcasts, then StarCast. And you've also, oh, by the way, had a gig on Vice TV.
Well, that was, again, wrestling related.
Sure.
But there's a fabulous show called Dark Side of the Ring.
Right.
And before it was launched, they invited Bruce and I into their studios in New York to do a screener of their very first episode, the pilot, you might call it, about Bruiser Brody. And we loved it. And so Bruce and Eric and everybody else I was working with, I sort of closed the gap and helped facilitate some of those guests. And I still do. If I have a number on someone they can't find and just really believe in what Evan and Jason have been doing with that series. So during the pandemic, there was an appetite for more of that content. So they wanted to do something called Dark Side of the Ring Confidential, where they aired clips that had never been seen before, and we added some more context to the behind-the-scenes of the creation of that. So they asked us right in the middle of the pandemic to shoot this at the former ECW arena in South Philadelphia. So Cassio and I jumped in my car and drove all the way up there because we didn't want to fly because this is the COVID era. So here we are slipping around in a car that doesn't have four-wheel drive, driving on iced over streets with really just sheets of ice, hoping, is that the Airbnb they put us up in? Because at the time, we're not even staying in hotels. It was really crazy, but we did it, and it was a blast. And yeah, I never imagined that I would be on television. Like, guys who look and sound like me are not supposed to be on television. But there I was, thankful for the opportunity.
Well, I mean, this has been a cool walk, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And best. Still is. I mean, and I don't know if it's been a walk or a run or both. But
at times, both.
Yeah. But then you got a call in 2023.
Yes.
And you have now been inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Yeah, in Waterloo, Iowa.
What the heck?
I can't believe it. Like, you know, they have an award there called the Gordon Solie Award, who's arguably the dean of professional wrestling, just one of the greatest voices and commentary professionals, play-by-play, in the history of wrestling. So he was the first recipient, and the second recipient was what I consider the real voice of wrestling of my generation, Jim Ross.
Okay.
And when they had a committee and they voted on who should be the next to receive the award, they chose me. And at that point, I had never actually worked for a wrestling organization beyond my WWE Network TV show. And I kind of thought, are you sure? Like, there's so many other worthwhile and worthy individuals. But they asked, and I answered and said yes. And to my surprise, Bruce agreed to come in and give my induction speech and introduce me. And even more added pressure, I thought, hey, I'm the nobody. So at least we'll get it out of the way early, and then we can go to dinner. No, they wanted me to go last. And now it's like you have all this pressure of everyone looking at it. It's like, I'm not even supposed to be here.
And now for our keynote speaker.
Right. And I'm not even a wrestler. I've never taken a bump, as they call it in the wrestling ring. I shouldn't be up here. But I was very thankful and appreciative that last year I was able to nominate, and there was 100% unanimous votes for that. Tony Schiavone,
how about that,
went in the Hall of Fame. And that was his very first Hall of Fame. And he started broadcasting wrestling in 83.
Wow.
And to think I may have had a hand in nominating him to go into the Hall of Fame in 2024 was just surreal. So
you're just thankful. You're just gumping again.
Gumping, man.
You're just gumping the entire time.
I'm gumping it. By the way, shout out to Waterloo, Iowa. It's the Thez and Tragos Hall of Fame, the Dan Gable Museum in Waterloo, Iowa. It's going down this July. I'll be there again. This year, Eric Bischoff's going in, so I'm pumped about that.
Is there a special jacket? Do you wear like a Ric Flair robe? What do you wear when you go to an award ceremony?
No,
like
I mean, I think they want you to wear a suit, but they do give you a cool plaque, and your name is displayed there in the museum. And I mean, just the idea that I'm in a professional wrestling Hall of Fame as the mortgage guy.
Cool.
If you could tell 7-year-old me that, it would blow his mind. It'd be the coolest thing
very,
ever.
That is absolutely very cool. All right, so you got this crazy life. Did you ever imagine this stuff? I mean, you've definitely got two sides to your professional life. Both of them are still gainful and still going.
Yeah.
And both of them are still time takers, and both of them you still have people that work for you here, there, and the other, and you're running and gunning. Did you ever imagine? I mean, where'd you come from? Where did Conrad Thompson come out of the womb as an entrepreneur, or did something happen? What got you to the point that you are able to step into entrepreneurship with this kind of brash boldness that you seem to project right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, I appreciate that. I like brash boldness. If that's the way people describe me, that would
write
be cool.
That down for
right?
Brash,
yeah.
And bold,
I like right? it. No, my grandfather, I guess maybe this is part of it, he was in the Amway business and did really well.
Oh, wow.
I never even studied Amway, but I guess people get impressed when I say he was double diamond. I guess that's a thing. I don't know. But I guess he did pretty well at that. And then unfortunately, he and my grandmother got divorced, and things were never the same for either of them after that. Mm. But my mom partnered with my grandmother, and they started a domiciliary. You and I, being country folks, might call it an old folks home, where they're not quite ready to go to, you know, full-time care like a nursing home, but they do need somebody to just help them around the house and that sort of thing. So they created that, and then my dad started, he worked at the prison system. He was a security guard. Or a prison guard, and he would, you know, do drug tests and whatever other tasks they had him handle at the prison there. But that wasn't enough. You know, they needed more income. So Dad started selling insurance part-time, and then he started selling vacuum cleaners part-time, and that proved to be more lucrative. And eventually my dad was earning far more money selling vacuum cleaners in the evenings and on weekends than he was working for the state as a security guard at the prison. So he had an opportunity to have his own territory, and eventually he jumped at it. So we went from Prattville, Alabama, a suburb of Montgomery, up to Gunnersville, and that's where I graduated high school. But I saw my parents' life change from where, you know, mom was telling me, don't answer the phone, that's grown folks' business. Those are bill collectors.
Yeah.
And I learned things like if you mail the cable bill to the power company and the power bill to the cable company, it'll buy you a few more days. You know, so I grew up with that. And I remember wanting to be able to do better and provide more for my mom. And so when I saw that become a realization, you know, now we're taking fancy trips to Cancun and we have a two-story house and an in-ground pool and mom's driving a Lincoln. I remember what that felt like. So I just decided right then, hey, I'm going to be in sales. I want to do sales.
How about that?
So when I was a sophomore at Gunnersville High School, I got as silly as this sentence sounds, a full ride at Sneed. But Sneed State Community College had a program called the Ambassador Program. And if you were chosen to be one of the Marshall County ambassadors through a series of testing and interviews and things like that, they would allow you to go to Sneed. So I did that. And in 2000, Van Scott, who was my business professor, and I had so many classes with him, he said something along the lines of, now, folks, if you keep your nose clean and you keep your head down, some of you in this room could earn up to $35,000 a year.
Which sounded like money.
But I reached in my book bag at the end of class, and I realized here we are in September, and my year to date is like 60 grand.
There you go.
So I came to Van after the room had cleared out, and I said, hey, I think this was my last class. And he says, are you dropping the class? Because I'd had several with Mr. Scott. And I said, no, I think I'm dropping school. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you said if I keep my head down and I keep my nose clean, I could earn $35,000 a year, but here's my paycheck stub. And he looks at it, and he looked up at me and said, son, you make more than me. Why are you here? And patted me on the arm, and that was it. I never went back.
How about that?
And before I knew it, I moved to Huntsville because I wanted to be where the people were. If you're in a sales job, you need to go where the people are.
Yeah.
So living in Gunnersville, 6,000 people at the time or whatever it is, I went to Huntsville, rented an apartment, and 11 months later, I bought a house, and mortgages, here we come.
Well, so looking back to your family, I mean, I heard a couple things in there. I heard work ethic.
Oh, yeah.
I heard my pastor said, just last Sunday, actually, he said, if we don't quit, we win.
That's right.
And there was a bit of that mixed in there.
Oh, yeah.
More than work ethic, it sounded like there was also a tenacious effort to not quit.
Absolutely. My dad is my hero, and he instilled a great work ethic in me. He instilled a positive mental attitude. You know, I feel bad for folks who grew up in a household that just breeds negativity. That's not the household I grew up in.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were just drilling into me that I could do anything I wanted. My mom painted a vision for me that one day I'd have Rolls Royces and live behind gates and all this crazy stuff. And then later, you know, as a teenager, Ric Flair did promos on TBS that I was watching on a VHS tape. I'm watching it in 97, but he said it in 87. That he wanted to live in the biggest house on the biggest hill on the big side of town, and he's got a limousine a mile long and blah, blah, blah. So he was talking about swag, as the kids would say in these rap songs today, way back then. And as a 15, 16-year-old, it was like, yeah, that all sounds pretty good. I think I'd like that. And I felt like sales was maybe my ticket there. But I grew up selling, you know, I mean, I thought I would sell insurance or I would sell vacuum cleaners like my dad. But then a neighbor next door to our suite in Huntsville at the office suggested that I come sit with him one day, and he taught me about mortgages. And I'm 19 at the time.
How about that?
I don't even know that I don't know how to spell mortgage. I certainly don't know there's two G's in it. I would have never guessed that. But I remember looking at it and saying, okay, Jeff, I get we're saying their payment goes from $1,300 to $900. But if their payment goes down $400, how do we make money? Because as a salesperson, I was used to think of like the car scenario. If you go buy a new car, you're going to get a new payment. So I'm just thinking, wait a minute, we're not charging them more. We're charging their less. Where's the margin for us? I couldn't wrap my head around it. But once I realized, oh no, it's based on the loan value. So you're making your commission on their $300,000 mortgage. Well, as a guy who would been thinking about selling $1,500 vacuum cleaners and making a commission on that, it was like, oh, this could be quite lucrative. So I went and told Dad, hey, Dad, I think I'm going to quit and try this. And Dad and I really came to an impasse because he felt like, hey, I'm only building an outfit here in Huntsville for you to run it. I still had one in Albertville.
That was Dad's company you were looking
at. Yeah, at that point, Dad had an office in Gadsden.
Wow.
He had one in Albertville. Yeah. He had one in Huntsville. And I was kind of running the Huntsville one, but I was like, Dad, this is another level. We got to – so Dad didn't see it. And Dad thought, you know, it was not going to be nearly as lucrative as it was. But it afforded me the opportunity to buy my first house and buy my first Rolex. And when I was a kid, I had to have an Escalade, you know, all that silly stuff. So about a year later, Dad was like, so how do you make money with this? So eventually I got Mom in, I got Dad in, I got my cousins in, I got my uncle in, and I started First Family Mortgage because it really was everybody, my sister's here, everybody's here. So it was a fun way to sort of share that with my parents. I mean, their lifelong dream had always been to own a place in Panama City. And as I'm sitting here with you today, I can say they did it, and it was because of the mortgage business. So it's all been a positive, really fun story, man.
How about that? That is way cool. Well, listen, so all these different parts of your life. So what's your mode? I mean, do you sleep late? Do you get up early? Are you the guy who's like already scheming before the crack of dawn, or are you the guy who works to the wee hours of the night and then sleep till 10? What's your mode? I mean, how do you structure your day to get all this done?
Well, my wife decided a couple of years ago she wanted to get into fitness. So she's training for competitions all the time.
Wow.
So I went from being the first person up to now she is. She's up at 3:30 in the morning and at the gym by 4.
No kidding.
As you may have been able to tell, I am not there at 4 in the morning. I am still asleep. But no, I'm up every day before 7 and getting after it. I always usually try to have an 8 a.m. appointment somewhere. Today it was about our big convention in Dallas. But at 9 o'clock, I did a podcast from 9 to 11. I jumped in my car, came straight here to you.
Yeah.
I've guessed that our show would be about 90 minutes, so I have a 1:30 as soon as this finishes for my ride back. And then I've got a 2:30 right behind that, and then I'll pick up a professional wrestler flying in from Mexico at the Huntsville International Airport tonight at 6:45. And I'll take him to dinner and make sure he's situated and then take him to have some cervezas. And then we'll bring him back to the house and introduce him to the wife before she goes to bed. And we'll do it again tomorrow.
Wash, rinse, repeat.
Every single day from the minute I wake up until I go to bed, I'm doing something that makes money or is fun, or else I'm not doing it. But those are my two prerequisites. I want to have fun or make money. And if I can do both, I'm doing a lot of it.
How about that?
Yeah.
How about that? All right. Let me ask you this. Let's get into other stuff. So
sure.
You did, Mrs. Thompson used to be a Flair.
Yes.
All right. You met Ric Flair. You told me the story. Y'all were drinking buddies and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then you started doing a podcast together. So I'm sure that not only did you get to know him, but then you really got to work with him as well to some degree. So he's one of the legends of the world of pro wrestling.
Yes.
What's your craziest Ric Flair story?
None that we can tell on a fine podcast like this. But, you know, what you see is what you get with Ric Flair. You know, his real name is Richard Flair.
Right.
But I don't think he can differentiate between the two even now. I mean, it is it's wild, the boldness and the brashness, as you would say, that people have. I remember walking through the Atlanta airport with him once, and a guy just pops up out of nowhere and puts his cheek against his as we're walking through the concourse. And holds his phone up like people are taking selfies with their cheek against him, like not even speaking to him like he's a human being, like it's a statue somewhere. It's just surreal. But I've seen a lot of that, and sometimes depending on the mood he's in, it's less than favorable for them. But he's always got plenty of time. If you're a veteran, if you're a child, if you're a special needs individual, or if you're an attractive woman, you got a shot at having a good conversation with him. If you look like me or Butters, you probably need to keep it moving.
I did see, though, some interview with you where you said that you found one of Ric Flair's robes on an online auction or something like that.
Oh, yeah. So you saw.
And you got it.
Yes. I've had several robes through the years. I was collecting these robes before I knew Ric. No, but kidding. I knew they were investment vehicles. Let me explain. If you're not familiar with pro wrestling, he used to come to the ring in something that looks like Elvis Presley or Liberace would wear it.
More like Liberace, I would
there you
say,
go.
Yeah.
But you remember like the jumpsuits that oh, yeah. Elvis wore with all oh, the yeah. sequins everywhere and the crazy designs? Well, Flair did that, and he thought it was a big part of the presentation. And that actually went back to Gorgeous George. Gorgeous George is kind of the innovator of that.
Yeah.
And even Muhammad Ali would say he borrowed from Gorgeous George's rap. It was all just about promotion. So Flair became, I guess, the second nature boy behind Buddy Rogers. and started putting that, you know, on some sequins on a robe. And they got more ornate and more fancy. But then one day I'm just scrolling. I'm a sports collector. So I have like an old pair of Ali's trunks and Tyson trunks. And I've got Joe Montana's jersey and just lots of silly stuff like that. But I thought from a wrestling fandom standpoint, like maybe the coolest thing you could own would be a Ric Flair robe. So I'm scrolling eBay and I found one and I couldn't believe it.
And it was legit.
It's legit. I knew it was legit. So I negotiated with the guy for the course of maybe 3 months. And then I bought a robe from him. And then when he got another one, he said, hey, do you want to buy this one? Well, I negotiated and got an even better deal. So I bought that one. So through the years, I've probably had 12 different ones. But there was one that always eluded me. One that was my really first impression of Rick is when he first came to the WWF in 1991. He showed up in a black robe with white feathers and it had silver butterflies on it. And it was on the cover of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. It was on the cover of the WWF magazine. And he wore it to the ring at the Royal Rumble in 1992.
Yeah.
And hardcore wrestling fans would say, that's the greatest Rumble of all time. It had the most legends. The winner became the champion. And Flair became the first guy to ever win the WWF title and the NWA title. It was a big deal. It would be like if all of a sudden, you know, Babe Ruth, you know, wasn't with the Yankees and now he's with the Red Sox sort of thing. It's like, oh my gosh, this is a big deal. And that robe, nobody could find for years and years and years.
Had Rick sold it? Had it been stolen?
Nobody knew.
Oh, wow.
Now, Flair had had a bunch of robes stolen from locker rooms and dressing rooms and airports. All he knew, and even ex-wives. But he did say, hey, I don't know where it is, so it's clearly stolen because I didn't sell it. Well, it turns out the story we've heard is he forgot after a Monday Nitro in 1995 and left it hanging in the closet in Johnson City, Tennessee at a Holiday Inn. And they didn't know how to get a hold of him because in 1995, it's not like everybody had cell phones like they do now.
Right.
So somebody just kept it. Well, while they were filming Most Wanted Treasures for A&E, which is a WWE program, they found it. Well, it turns out the guy who wound up seeing the auction on eBay, he actually had a program set up to track when anything Ric Flair related was listed, because he had found some interesting things through the years that way.
So the dude had his own algorithm for searching Ric Flair stuff.
He did. Wow. And he found this robe before anybody, and he bought it dirt cheap relative to its value. But I knew the guy because this little circle of high-end wrestling collectors is pretty small. There's probably six major ones. There's a lot of others on the periphery.
Are you one of the six?
I used to be. I'm not as active in it as I was. I found that I've gotten close enough now that my fandom has changed a little bit. I just view it differently, and I appreciate it differently. That's not to say I still don't have a pretty damn impressive collection. I do. But I'm just saying I'm no longer actively looking for the next thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But there's still a few things out there that, boy, if I could find that. But it's less about what else can I add to the collection and more about what are my grail pieces, if that makes sense.
Right.
Well, for years and years, I'd called out on podcasts because I would even watch along. I think in 2022, I watched, maybe it was before that, but on an anniversary date, I watched with Ric Flair that Royal Rumble back again. And I said on the end of the microphone, hey, if anybody can find that, I'd be glad to get you a brand new Forerunner. I mean, like my DMs are open. Here's my email address. Anytime that robe came up, I threw it out there. Well, this fellow knew, because we had done robe deals together, that I was interested. So he reached out to me, and we worked a deal out, and we sort of recreated it for the TV show. That's not exactly how it happened, but it's pretty close. But either way, he got a wire, which was almost as much as I spent for my first house, and now I have the robe.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Good
but
Lord.
There's only a handful of things that I really, really wanted, and I had already achieved accidentally. My first wrestling collectible was the big gold belt. And it's the one that Ric Flair debuted on Valentine's Day in 1986, but they used it all the way through the end of WCW in 2001. So the same belt that he wore and Dusty Rhodes wore and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and Sting is the same belt that like Hulk Hogan with the NWO played air guitar with on Nitro and Goldberg beat him. And the idea that I was able to find that, I thought, man, this would be like finding like the Super Bowl trophy. They make a new one every year. This is like the Stanley Cup.
Wait, I'm taking it back. They make a new one every year?
Well, yeah. If you go to Robert Kraft's office, I'm sure he's got a bunch of those trophies.
He's still got his trophy.
Yeah. Yes. But I'm saying this one, they didn't make a bunch of copies of. Like, that was the NWA belt. In the WWF, like, they just make, like, five or six a year. So there's just several of them that have this design. But this particular belt was three pieces of metal and one strip of leather, and it was used from 86 to 2001. So when I found that, I was like, this is like the coolest collectible ever. The second coolest would be if I could find Ric Flair's 1992 Royal Rumble robe.
And that's the-
and when I did, I was like, oh, I got to put them together.
Okay, so but now I got to chase this rabbit then real quick. Two questions. What is the most coveted piece of your personal collection of any kind of sports? Because I heard you say you're a big sports collector in general. And what is the one thing that's still out there that, by God, you haven't found it yet, but you're gonna?
That's easy. The big gold belt's number one. That's not close. I've been offered six figures for
it
multiple times.
Is it hanging on a wall in a shadow box, or is it locked in a safe deposit box?
WWE has it right now. They just had WrestleMania, and they wanted to display it. They put Lex Luger in the Hall of Fame finally, and that's a belt that he famously beat on the 100th Nitro.
You are Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
So he called, the archivist from WWE called and said, can I borrow the belt? And I said, absolutely. We've done it a dozen times before.
Yeah.
So they have it right now, so it's on loan.
Okay.
But so normally, it's at my house.
So what have you not found? What is the thing?
The one I haven't found.
What is the thing that if you could track it down?
The WrestleMania 4 or 5 or 6 Winged Eagle Championship. The world title that was worn by Hulk Hogan, the Ultimate Warrior, or the Macho Man. The reason I'm specific about those three is they were dual plated. So it was nickel and gold starting at WrestleMania 6. Every belt after that and through WrestleMania 14 was like all gold. But the look of that one, because that's when I really fell in love, was WrestleMania 5. The first WrestleMania I saw was on a double tape VHS at my grandfather's house. Once upon a time, we used to go to like movie gallery. Remember those days?
Man, yeah.
And so that's what my parents did. They were like, hey, this is a double tape set. This will be a heck of a babysitter for our 7-year-old annoying son. So I got to watch WrestleMania 4 and fell in love with pro wrestling. I had never seen it before. I was a G.I. Joe He-Man guy. So now to be able to see this was like, this is like a real life cartoon. I'm in. So if I could have the world title that one of those guys held when I first fell in love with wrestling, that would be it. But I've never found one person who has one or can even say they've seen it. So it's still out there somewhere. But I'll find it eventually. Time's on my side.
Can you find me the glasses that Roddy Piper wore in the movie They're Here and that shows him where the aliens
they
are?
They live.
They live. That's right. They live. I
might be able to find that. No, seriously. There is a niche collector. I know two people who would know where that is.
No kidding.
Yeah. The Underground Railroad of Wrestling Collectibles. Here I am as the Forrest Gump of that, too.
All right, let me ask you a couple quick questions about your knowledge of the wrestling industry, shall we say.
Sure.
Massive stage events. Has there ever been a time, because like we had the thing with John Cena just had the big event, right?
Yep, WrestleMania.
Like his closing, like the closure of his career, correct?
He's announced this is his farewell tour. His last day in the professional wrestling business will be December 31st, 2025.
What I've seen as a casual observer, and that's where I am. I'm a casual observer. But what I've seen as a casual observer is they weave storylines. Mm-hmm. And the storylines have sometimes a beginning and an end, but at the very least, the fans know what the storyline is, or they're given the trailer that tells them why there may be more coming.
Yes.
That being said, is there ever been, in your study of the history, has there been one where, like, they never got closure? Like, something happened, and that character, if you will, never got the actual. All right, so what would you bring closure to if you could? Like, I know you organize events. I know you've been a part of, like, Ric Flair's final.
Yes.
And you've seen some other big events, and you've got StarCast and other things you work with. Event-wise, if you could bring closure in time, anybody, well, who would it be?
You're saying we have a time machine?
Yes.
Hulk Hogan's last match.
Hulk Hogan's.
It was a 6-man tag in Europe. It wasn't promoted as being his last match. I don't think he knew it would be his last match, but that's the way the cookie crumbled. It wasn't even filmed. It was just for the people in that building. I think it was Germany. I could be wrong. But somewhere in Europe, maybe it was London. I don't know. But somewhere, not America, no television cameras, not pay-per-view, Hulk Hogan's last match would have been pretty damn big. And it's a shame we missed that. But
and it probably should have been big.
It would have been incredibly big. Yeah.
So he's still alive.
Yeah, but he's no longer.
He's also what?
In his 60s, I guess. Respectfully, he walks with a cane now. I mean, we couldn't physically do it.
Well.
But he's still, I don't know if you saw, but just yesterday as we're recording this, he was on Fox and Friends announcing his new promotion, Real American Freestyle. So it's not pro wrestling, but it is pro wrestling. I mean that to say it's not sports entertainment like WWE, but if you were an incredible amateur wrestler in the ranks of the NCAA, but you decide you don't want to get punched in the face and learn jiu-jitsu. So your goal isn't UFC. And you don't really want to follow Kurt Angle's footsteps and become a sports entertainer with WWE. You just want to continue to pursue and compete in your lifelong passion of amateur wrestling. You know, how would you do that and make a living at that? Well, as of 2 days ago, there was no way to do that. But they just announced yesterday Real American Freestyle. So I imagine there will be profile pieces like you might have seen on American Idol or The Voice where you understand guys' motivations and their why. So we get to see them at home or training or, you know, what's going on with their little girl or what was their childhood like. Or we're going to try to make the characters more relatable than just, hey, here's this random guy in blue tights and here's this random guy in green tights. And they're going to have the pyro and the smoke and the screens and the big-time presentation like you would see at a WWE or a UFC. But it'll be different because it will be more amateur wrestling style. So it's called Real American Freestyle. And it just so happens that Hulk Hogan's theme song in wrestling was Real American by Rick Derringer.
Yeah.
And his beer is Real American Beer. So I'm sure there's connective tissue there for marketing purposes, but Hogan and my pal Eric Bischoff are behind it, and they're having their first event in Cleveland on August 30th.
And he's still Thunderlips to some.
Absolutely. Forever Thunderlips.
Speaking of movies, so if you've seen it, one of the saddest movies that had a genuine sense of feel to it would be The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
You seen that one?
I have, yes, sir.
Does that have a sense of accuracy to it?
A million percent.
Really?
Yeah. The
tragedy story, for those who don't know, of a guy who had trouble leaving behind his wrestling life when his body wouldn't let him keep up, and other events in life, as a matter.
Well, yeah. Specifically, he put wrestling in front of everything.
Everything.
Including marriages, including his responsibilities as a father, his financial well-being, his own physical well-being.
It was his identity.
It was.
And he lost everything else because of it.
And he couldn't let go of that feeling and the dream, and he hung on too long. And there, I think, you know, that was the reality for a lot of professional wrestlers. But guys who may have been in that situation or circumstance 15 years ago when that movie came out, they're not now because of the rebirth of nostalgia, which I do think in large part is because of podcasting.
Podcasting and the internet give it a second life.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Like, you and I could put together, I don't know if you saw, but as we're recording just last week, they did a pop culture expo in Huntsville. Well, there weren't a ton of stars who have a hit show on NBC this week at that event. It was, you know, My Name is Earl, which was on NBC 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So nostalgia is very much in fashion. You know, they did the guy from Ghostbusters was there. I mean, and that movie came out 40 some odd years ago. So nostalgia is very, very marketable right now. So if the Mickey Rourke character, Randy the Ram was his character's name, if he was around today, Randy the Ram would still be making six figures working 2 days a week. He'd make more today than he did when he was actually wrestling.
How about that?
Yeah. So it's a lot better now.
Well, the Randy the Ram character was legit in terms of its realism.
That's right.
I watched that, and it was one of those movies that kind of left me just feeling almost crestfallen for the guy as
I
watched it. But there's also some amazing personalities in the industry. They have to be. They're all larger than life to some degree, whether they're on the pro or the con side, you know, whether they're the bad guy or the good guy in the ring at that particular moment. They've all got this incredible persona. And then they've got some that bring the character to life with makeup and more additional Ric Flair style.
Yes.
That being said, there's some crazy athleticism in there, too.
Oh, the best athletes
in
the world.
There's no way to fake some of what happens. I mean, people can look at it and go, how much of that is real? Well, did you just do a double gainer off the ropes and land in the crowd and walk away from it? Nobody else could. So athletics. How much of what you see in the industry right now is like bona fide athletics, and who is the greatest athlete in wrestling?
Well, athlete. That's a great question. I want to say the greatest athlete in the history of wrestling might be Kurt Angle.
Okay.
Kurt Angle won the Olympic gold medal in wrestling for the United States in 1996, and he did it with a broken neck. And the way he was able to do that is he would train to failure, and when the muscles failed in his body and they were no longer firing, that's when he would really start training. Like most people, train to failure and then stop, he would persist. His ability to focus and block out the pain was at times his best friend when it came to his athletic pursuits. But now, as an older gentleman, he's paying the price for that. He's had a double knee replacement. I don't know a lot of guys who have not just a double knee replacement, but at the same time. But, like, his brain is like, well, I don't want to have to be out, you know, 9 months with one knee and 9 months with another. Let's just do them both. And that requires relearning how to walk completely. But he did it. So it's probably Kurt Angle as far as the best athlete. But the athletes of today are even, by and large, as a rule, even more athletic than they used to be. Because we know so much more about diet and nutrition, and the schedule is a lot looser than it used to be. Back in Ric Flair's day, he would legitimately have a schedule that would make your mind melt. 300 days a year, never home.
On the road constantly.
On the road constantly, in a different hotel. And in that era, it's not like you had your smartphone that had all of your itinerary. He traveled with a paperclip of airline tickets. I mean, it was just – and back then, people don't even think about this. He's lugging those big robes around. Luggage didn't even have wheels on it. I mean, so just you're all
– I said that to my wife recently. Whoever came up with wheels on a suitcase was a genius.
Genius. Give that man all the credit.
Yeah.
The athleticism is definitely different today because people don't have to – I mean, you got to think about it. If you're a professional athlete like Ric Flair back then, you're in the main event, which means you're going on last. So you can't go out there and wrestle for an hour if you just had a heavy dinner. So now you've got to figure out how to eat afterwards. Well, if you're not leaving the arena until 11:30 at night, not a lot of great healthy options to go choose from. Mm-hmm. But he managed to find a way to do it through that. But he also did it with a ton of beer and a ton of alcohol and a ton of booze. And, well, the wrestlers today don't do that. Now, you know, they have a separate suitcase with all their meal prep. So there's the little individual containers they're going to slide in a microwave. Well, Flair didn't have the ability to do that. Right. Everybody didn't have a microwave, and there weren't meal delivery services. So you have much better conditioned athletes. Like, you take a look at my sister-in-law. Her real name's Ashley, but she wrestles for WWE as Charlotte Flair.
Okay.
She's in phenomenal shape, but she was a personal trainer before she got into wrestling. So, I mean, the athletes of today are just far superior to what they used to be. However, what draws the most money in wrestling is personality.
Yeah.
It's not the athleticism or the stunts.
I see that.
But the thing about the
showmanship is still there.
Oh, it has to be.
Yeah.
But the fake word that you were talking about, the results are predetermined. But that doesn't necessarily affect your enjoyment. And I've had this conversation with people who are like, well, no, that's stupid. Like, if you know what's going to happen at the end, why do you watch? Well, did you watch Titanic?
That's right.
Did you reckon the boat wasn't going down? Like, is Rocky not going to win at the end? Like, what do you think's going to happen in these movies? Like, why would you waste your time on that silliness? The action, no, they're not punching each other full force in the face. But the ring is not a trampoline. It's reinforced steel, crisscrossed, and then with wooden slats all along it. I'm talking about like the wood that's in your house that holds it up and keeps it from caulking.
Now, there's got to be a lot of ice packs and Bengay after each one of those rounds.
It's unbelievable. They did a study on this a few years ago on the Science Channel, and they said that every bump, so when a guy just falls flat of his back, they teach you things like you want to throw your arms out to distribute the weight so you don't just take it all in one spot. You want to tuck your chin so you don't give yourself a concussion, things like that. But they said every time that you fall like that, it's the equivalent of being in a 35-mile-an-hour car wreck. Well, my sister-in-law at WrestleMania, she maybe was in 45 car wrecks in the course of 20 minutes. Like, when you just think about it that way, it's like, okay, I get it. It's different.
Well, I mean, so my version of relating to that is I was a paratrooper.
Yeah.
And I've got three fused vertebrae in my neck.
Oh, wow.
Even though I was trained how to roll.
Yes.
And every single jump was, to some degree, widely controlled. But there's no way to account for everything.
That's right.
And that tree comes up, and you don't have a thing to do about it. You just got to land. And, you know, so I am certain that there's guys who are walking away from rings who aren't going to be able to wrestle the next night at times, from what I've been watching.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Adam Copeland, who used to wrestle for WWE under the name Edge, he did an interview earlier this week, and he says after a match, he's around the 50-year-old mark, and he says after a match, it takes him around two weeks before he starts to walk normally again.
God almighty.
Hulk Hogan, before he gets out of bed, it takes, I've heard, up to 30 minutes for him to get out of bed. People don't think about this because Hulk Hogan wasn't necessarily known for having these really spectacular moves like you were talking about, a double gainer off the top rope or anything. But what he was is 303 pounds, and he'd get a running start, jump as high as he could, and then fall directly on his spine doing what he called a leg drop. But that's how he won all of his matches. He'd hit a leg drop.
Yeah.
Well, now you've got 303 pounds just pounding, driving right in.
He did that in the Rocky movie.
Yes. He did it in every match he ever had. And at the time, you know, oh, that hurts a little bit. You're not thinking about all the pressure that puts on your spine and the stuff in between your different vertebrae. I mean, he's probably had 24 back surgeries. And it's from that one move that all of us would say, well, that's not that spectacular looking. I would challenge you, go watch Dale Earnhardt's last race. His wreck was not the most spectacular looking wreck you've ever seen.
Yeah.
But the back injury is not one to fool with.
So, but you bring up a point. So Dale Earnhardt's wreck resulted in some additional safety measures being added.
Yes.
There are now head straps. There are things in place that NASCAR will not let you race without. So have there been times when somewhere in the industry someone said, look, no more of that?
A ton. So you used to see, like you said early, I used to see a guy hit another guy over the head with a steel chair. That doesn't happen anymore. There's no we're very conscious about CTE. We didn't know what we didn't know back then.
Yeah.
So there was once a point of pride where guys wouldn't even want to put their hands up to protect themselves. They thought it made you look weak or less than. You're less of a man. You just grin and bear it. I mean, I remember playing football as a kid. They'd say, oh, you got to rub some dirt on it. Walk it off. I mean, I remember smelling salts on foot. Those guys were concussed. And we're hoping we can just send them right back. We didn't know any better.
Yeah.
But now we know better. So now there are things like concussion protocol. There's been guys who've had their ring career cut short because they had, you know, something different with their heart that years ago they would have never even tested for. So wrestling has gotten a lot better about protecting the performers within it.
And that's the only way to preserve the industry, really.
Absolutely.
All right. So I tell you what, as we wind down our time, I got a couple more for you.
Sure.
If you were to be in the ring yourself.
Oh, gosh.
If and you were in the ring yourself.
Yes.
What would be your character? What would be your shtick?
Well, I think it'd be Conrad the Mortgage Guy.
Conrad the Mortgage Guy.
And my finisher would be the foreclosure. That's how I would send them home.
You've thought of this before.
Well, people have asked me, you know, a lot. And I remember as a kid watching games or watching sporting events or even when my friends were playing Tecmo Bowl, I wanted to do commentary. And I would find a way to make it funny. I didn't want to do boring commentary. I wanted to be silly, over the top, and be funny. So those sort of things have always – I mean, I remember recording it with my little microphone. We all had like a little recorder as a kid, and you'd have a little cassette tape, and you'd record silly things into it. So, I mean, I remember doing all of that as a kid, and never did I ever imagine I might actually get paid to talk into a microphone. That seemed crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
It is.
But here we are.
Here we are.
All right. So last question for you, brother. I've enjoyed this thoroughly.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for making time, because I've heard your schedule now, so I know that making time was something you had to make.
Well, but I had to call an audible. I was supposed to be here at 9 this morning, but we were supposed to record Eric Bischoff's podcast.
Oh, I wasn't going to tell the audience that, but there it is. Well, did kind of shaft me and make sure that
I'm glad to do it, too. When I saw my buddy Eric on Fox and Friends Thursday, I thought, well, I guess that means we're not recording in an hour, but their whole schedule changed. And when that did, mine did too. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's not even a thing, man. We're here all day. But let me ask you, podcasts do more than just talk to the moment. They also preserve for future time.
Yes.
All right. So we're 30, 40, 50 years from now and somebody resurrects this footage.
Okay.
What and you're raising two girls.
That's right.
You know, eventually you're going to be a pawpaw.
I hope so.
What do you want the takeaway for your future generations of your family to take from this particular discussion? What do you want their takeaway of you to be?
Wow, no pressure, huh? Man, that's a deep question. I mean, I do think, you know, the positive mental attitude is a great way to live life, and I would encourage anybody who is in a dark place in their life or they're not sure what to do, I would encourage you to change, sort of parent yourself with your own thinking. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, Zig Ziglar has a fabulous clip that's widely available on YouTube that someone ripped off and uploaded, and I guess they didn't monetize it, so they never took it down. But I remember hearing it as a kid when I was really trying to cut my teeth in sales, and it's the prime the pump story. Have you heard that before?
I think I have, but go ahead.
The idea being, if you were in rural Mississippi as a door-to-door salesman like he was once upon a time, you might find yourself thirsty, and you might need something to drink, and you might find a well, but as anybody who's ever worked on a well knows, you really got to prime the pump before that water will start coming.
Sure.
But that is a metaphor for life, because you never know when that water is going to start coming. So you just got to really give it your all and keep pumping and keep pumping and keep pumping. But if you give up, the water just goes all the way back down to the bottom and you'll never get the water. And the advice is keep pumping, and eventually the water will be there. But you've got to have that self-belief yourself, because if you can't see it, it won't happen. And when you give up, you lose. Just like your pastor said this past Sunday.
We don't quit, we win.
That's right. Well, I would challenge you to adjust your thinking about everything in life that way. It can't be like, hey, make me the manager and I'll start showing up on time. That's not the way life works. You've got to put in the work and then you'll get the reward. And you've got to really believe that. But how many kids would have gotten a full ride in school if they'd have studied for just one more hour?
No doubt.
How many people would have set a sales record and been able to afford that new boat that their wife wanted or whatever if they'd made just one more sale? I mean, that's the idea and the mentality. And I've tried to with everything I do. I do have goals, but I believe in daily goals. I think an annual income goal is a demotivator. I think people get overwhelmed with it. They get in their head and they get negative. And a lot of things happen. Let me give a mortgage example. We may have a deal fall apart because, you know, someone has a lien on their house we didn't know about. But a company like you may show me a title that says, oh, here's something I didn't know about. Well, my deal may be dead. And I've worked on this deal for 3 weeks now, but now it's dead because there's a title issue. Or it may die because I send the file into underwriting and a tax return is not exactly the way an underwriter wants to see it. My processor and I saw it differently than the way the underwriter does, and my deal is dead. Well, both of those deals died, and it wasn't necessarily because of me. Like, I didn't make the tax return bad. I didn't put the lien there. I did everything I was supposed to do, and it didn't work out. Now, I can choose to have two reactions to that. I can fuss and kick and scream and say life's not fair and this sucks and play, oh, pity party, woe is me victim.
Sure.
Or I can say, you know what? I should have just called another one. So I no longer focus on how many loans I close. I focus on how many conversations I start. Because sales is a contact sport. The more contacts you make, the more success you'll have. Nobody's ever – the heaviest thing in your office to pick up is that little square rectangle called a phone. I mean, you pick that piece of plastic up and put it to your ear and things will happen. But success is not looking for you. You got to be looking for it. So I would encourage everybody who's in a place where they're lost in life, and I'm not just giving a sales metaphor. I mean about anything. If you'd worked on your marriage a little more, if you'd worked on your relationship with God a little more, if you'd have read one more book, if you'd have spent one more moment with your son or daughter or whatever it may be, what's wrong with trying to give a little more? And that's what Zig Ziglar taught me when I was a kid, and that's the reason here I am trying to fit in a trip to Gadsden on a random weekday. I want a little more.
Brother, I don't know if I can take much more than that. That is good stuff right there, and
thanks,
I appreciate your time.
Me,
You do good stuff, and I thank you for making time for Right Side.
Thanks for having us, man. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in, and it just tickles me to no end that we both know Cassio. How's that even possible?
Tell him I still got pictures.
I think he might too.
Hey, hope you guys enjoyed that one. Listen, check out our YouTube channel. Find us at Right Side Media. We're also on all of our social media platforms, and you can also find us at rightsidemedia.org. All of our content, just click subscribe, follow, or like, and we'll see you next time on Just Right.